So from here, we battle our way back to Soldier's Field, where the gondola station to the First Lady airship is. Once you exit the elevator, Elizabeth and DeWitt have some dialogue about her magical tear abilities again.
I don't think I understand how you do what you do. These tears.
I always thought of them as doors. When I was younger, I didn't just open the ones I found. I remember making them.
Making them?
I could go wherever I wanted. But I always wanted to come back.
To what?
I don't know. My family?
Huh. How do you do that? Whatever it is.
You know how I said I had plenty of time to read? Well, I tried to figure it out. I read literature on physics and other such things.
Yeah? And what did that teach you?
That there's a world of difference between what we see and what is.
Here we're getting more vibes that her gilded cage was holding her back from a world of possibilities. Her own family was holding her back. This is despite the fact that she supposedly didn't know who her family was and lived in a giant secluded tower controlled by evil wizards, but she's pretty, shows some cleavage, and so you nod your head and agree. After all this, we finally board the gondola, and on the way over, Elizabeth makes an inquiry.
When you were unconscious on the beach, you kept repeating a woman's name. Anna.
I don't want to talk about that.
I'm sorry. I shouldn't have pried. Where are you from, Mr. DeWitt?
New York.
What did you do there?
Business much like this. Something that really caters writing on a resume.
It was a fine thing you came along when you did.
How do you think I ended up here? I gambled, and now I owe money to men you don't want to be in debt to. I come here to pay it back. Me busting you out, what do you think that was? Charity?
Who sent you?
Somebody who was willing to take my marker in exchange for you.
Again, DeWitt is a very bad man. The player is likely more and more curious about who Anna is, though. As I already mentioned at the outset, Anna is DeWitt's daughter. But for the time being, he, Elizabeth, and the player are not quite aware of this. Now we make our way to the First Lady airship and finally board it.
You all right?
I want to see Paris. I want to see everything.
It's up to you now. There's no one...
Wait, what is that? 40 north by 74 west. That's not Paris, that's New York.
How did you know that?
One thing I had in that tower was time, Mr. DeWitt. Time to study things like geography.
I owed money. And there's a fellow who... He offered to wipe away my debt in exchange for you. Come on. Come on. Everything's gonna be okay. Will you just turn around and talk to me and we can...
Now, keep in mind that DeWitt literally explained to her moments ago that someone promised to clear his debt in exchange for her. Yet, somehow she thought we were still going to Paris. In any event, now the real fun begins.
Fresh air did the trick. This one's awake.
So you're this false shepherd we've been hearing so much about. Caused a mess of trouble at the raffle.
You Fitzroy?
Nothing but.
I got no quarrel with you or your vox populi. This is my airship you're hanging me out of, and I got perilous need of it.
Really? Because it sure look like old Comstock's airship to
Listen,
me.
Listen, I ain't looking for a fight.
There's already a fight, DeWitt. Only question is, which side you on? Comstock is the god of the white man, the rich man, the pitiless man. But if you believe in common folk, then join the Vox. If you believe in the righteous folk, Then join the Vox.
I just want my ship.
And the Vox shall give her to you. But first, you must help the Vox. Down in Finkton, there's a gunsmith who can supply weapons to our cause. Get our guns from him, and you shall have your ship back.
Again, Columbia uses quantum physics to suspend itself in midair, yet brings quarried rocks to the deck of an airship where imported Negro convicts can smash them by hand. Daisy's "There's Already a Fight, DeWitt" is also reminiscent of today's anti-racist rhetoric telling white people that if they don't participate in their own destruction, then they're just as bad as a genocidal maniac like Zachary Comstock, who somehow both wants to exterminate and enslave the world at the same time. Also consider here that Fitzroy needs us to find some Chinese gunsmith in a white ethnostate to supply her with weapons when she has Comstock's airship. In any event, we've now been dumped into Fink's industrial sector, where, over and over again, he repeats endless robber baron tropes on the loudspeakers.
You know, I wasn't born deaf. I hear what it is people are saying. Why is it, Mr. Fink, that we have to work 16 hours a day? No, let's be clear. I would like nothing more than to shorten your workday. But the fact is, I simply can't. Why not, you ask? Well, I can sum it up for you in one word. Morality. You see, my friends, the idle hand is the tool of the devil. You take industry from a man's hand, and what goes in its place? Whiskey, women, and dice. And I, for one, will not have that in our friendly little town. No, sir, I will not.
16-hour workdays probably did occur on occasion, but the American industrial worker in the 1890s actually had a 60-hour work week on average, or roughly 10 hours a day, 6 days a week. By the 1920s, this had changed to about 8 hours a day, 6 days a week. Now, industrialists certainly took advantage of workers, and labor struggles were a real thing. But rather than actually explore those struggles, the game just once again pivots to the Irish were seen as black mythos. Walking around these docks, we see Irish and black people working side by side in some kind of post-racial class-based struggle against exploitative, racist capitalist Jeremiah Fink. The problem here is that this just wasn't a thing in the 1910s. There was no racial harmony or alliance between African Americans and the Irish, or any other white group for that matter. All throughout the 1890s and early 1900s, black workers were repeatedly brought in, ironically by men like Jeremiah Fink, to break up white labor strikes. As one scholar put it, quote, "The image of the black male strikebreaker in the late 19th and early 20th centuries was a powerful and broadly provocative one, arousing the concern, albeit in opposing ways, of white trade unionists and black elites alike. That image haunted organized white labor," unquote. However, in recent years, a fair amount of the papers on black strikebreaking are quite amusing, insofar that they start or conclude with something like, "Strikebreaking by African Americans was not particularly extensive," while at the same time the paper itself is full of justifications and/or explanations for why it was so extensive. Something something blacks just wanted jobs and white people were racist. I would argue here that there was much more innate racial animus on both sides than these people would like to admit. But this is somewhat peripheral to the main point here, though, which is that race was a primordial part of labor struggles, and Bioshock is once again distorting history to suit its purposes, which essentially seems to be to convince Irish Americans to ally themselves with the growing anti-white coalition. Eventually, we catch up with Elizabeth, who is still angry about DeWitt not taking her to France. After running for a time, she's captured by Comstock's men. Then DeWitt has to gun down another horde of American patriots so he can rescue her. Or rather, so she can rescue him from falling off of Columbia with an air balloon she tears into our reality. Afterwards, the two argue.
Hey! I'm slipping!
Do not attempt to follow me, Mr. DeWitt!
Elizabeth, I've made an arrangement to get our airship back!
You can get us out of here!
Yes! I just need to supply enough weapons to arm an entire uprising.
And where will we get these weapons? From one of our many friends and allies?
A gunsmith in Finkton should be a walk in the park. What do you say, partners?
You're a liar, Mr. DeWitt, and a thug. But you're also my only means of reaching Paris.
So off go DeWitt and Elizabeth to find Fitzroy's Chinese gunsmith in the white ethnostate. In the lobby entrance to Finkton, we find a voxophone of Mr. Jeremiah Fink.
The truth is, I don't have a lot of time for all that prophecy nonsense. I tell you, belief is just a commodity. Old Comstock, well, he does produce, but like any tradesman, he's obliged to barter his product for the earthly ores. You see, one does not raise a barn on song alone. No, sir. That's Fink timber, a Fink hammer, and Fink's hand to swing it. He needs me, lest he soil his own.
To an extent, Fink is Columbia's Frank Fontaine. He never actually believed in Christianity, but saw it as a useful tool to manipulate the masses. But that's somewhat secondary to the more central idea here, which is that Columbia's foundation sits squarely on Jeremiah Fink's capitalist exploitation. Again, the idea that Ken Levine wants to convey here is that the wholesome, iconic image of white America we have in our minds was built on a lie, and underneath it is a sea of human exploitation. Moving on, DeWitt and Elizabeth soon realize they can't enter Finkton directly through the main entryway, so they try to bypass it by going downstairs. After murdering more Colombian police officers and destroying another George Washington automaton, Elizabeth discovers Cornelius Slate's locker, and her mother's diary happens to be inside.
Booker, it's Slate's locker. He must have worked here. This is my mother's diary. Why would Slate have it? My husband claims the child was created from whole cloth by divine will. I am a believer, but I am not a fool. His bastard shall not be raised under this roof. My mother, she had me locked in that tower.
Elizabeth.
I just want to get out of this city. Please.
This whole affair arguably seeks to question the sanctity of Jesus Christ's birth, but more concretely, it shows the young male gamer that everyone close to Elizabeth, even her own mother, has betrayed her. And our young male gamer, thus, is probably feeling an increasing desire at this point to protect this abused woman by getting her out of this terrible white Christian society. After this, DeWitt and Elizabeth board an elevator that will take them to Finkton. On the ride down, and do note that the ride is down, Mr. Fink calls you on the elevator's phone and says he wants to hire you, but he gives no further details and hangs up. Then, Mr. Fink addresses the general public over the intercom.
Now, some say to me, Fink, why is it that we get paid in tokens that are only good at the company store? Well, I'll tell you what, I'll be damned if I let any of you poor folk get robbed at some shady establishment. You see, the Fink company store brings you Fink products at a price designed specifically for the Fink worker.
This is definitely a reference to the now infamous company stores and towns of the late 19th and early 20th centuries, specifically to coal mining towns, and it ties into the whole mythos that the company stores own the souls of its workers through debt peonage and store monopolies. Though curiously, where comparisons can actually be made, company stores often charge less than independent stores. Price differentials in cases where the opposite was true can be attributed to transportation costs of goods into the isolated region. The fact that Irrational Games references the company towns here within a large urban sprawl is fairly misleading. Often, the reason why there was only a single company store in a company town was because the mining operation was in an isolated region that had no accessible roads or infrastructure. Many operations simply didn't have plans to be around much longer than a couple of years, and most towns were quite small, amounting to maybe 1,000 people or so. So, it didn't make sense for either the workers or the company to invest much in building up a full-blown town. Likewise, in such a case, it wouldn't make sense for independent retailers to set up shop there. Now, there were also very large and more permanent operations, and many of these did in fact abuse their employees. But company towns varied a great deal. There were veritable hellholes such as Butte, Montana, but then there were also towns like Hershey, Pennsylvania, and Scotia, California, which were absolutely wonderful places to live and work. Scotia, California was a timber operation that provided its workers with free life insurance, retirement pensions, and even had some of the most progressive lumber practices of any company at the time, foregoing clear-cutting entirely in favor of a sustainability model and planting their own nurseries. Now, there may have been some cases in which mining companies tried to hedge their losses when coal prices dipped by artificially increasing prices at their company store, but owning the store was not necessarily a good hedge against coal losses. At the Stonega mines in Virginia, where the sale price of coal fell from 7.5% more than the cost of production in 1929 to 12.4% less in 1933, net store profits also fell from 8% to negative 1% of sales. Now, some miners may have mistaken price increases caused by inflation as attempts by operators to reduce real wages. A retail food price index for stores at the Stonega mines in the adjacent non-union district in Virginia is strongly correlated, 0.797, with the U.S. Consumer Price Index for foods for the years 1918 to 1932, while showing almost no correlation, 0.036, or 0.089, with nominal wage rates at these mines. As far as scrip and debt peonage go, I'll quote economic historian Price Fishback at length here. Quote, debt peonage at the mines was unusual. It certainly is not implied merely by the existence of scrip. Debt peonage could only have existed if the miner owed the company money on payday. Even then, it cannot be confirmed without greater knowledge of the circumstances of the loan. Both the Immigration Commission and the Coal Commission suggested that scrip was rarely extended beyond the amount due the employee on payday. Records of the Stonega Coke and Coal Company agreed. Between 1910 and 1947, outstanding accounts at the stores averaged about 1.9%, with a range of 0.45 to 4.68%. Store correspondence during the 1930s shows that store owners carefully monitored these accounts and sought quick repayment. Unquote. Now, to be clear, I'm not denying that abuses of American workers occurred during the so-called Gilded Age. Nevertheless, the historical situation was much more complex and warrants a careful, nuanced exploration. If you want a good book on company towns, I would suggest The Company Town by Hardy Green. Unlike Ken Levine and Irrational Games, Green's goal wasn't to render white America in the most negative light as possible, so you get a much more contextualized analysis rather than an assemblage of negative caricatures and tropes. Again, the mythos surrounding company town exploitation isn't entirely false. As previously stated, though, many company towns were great places to live and work. But this gets us into the topics of corporate welfare and paternalism, which are also something Bioshock Infinite somewhat explores via Fink's character, with his constant fixation on lions, cattle, and hyenas. Fink and Columbia's elites are the lions ruling over the cattle, or the workers. Daisy Fitzroy is what Fink calls a hyena, meaning someone who simply causes trouble among the cattle. Of course, the genius of the lion-cattle analogy is that it immediately suggests a relationship of predator-prey to the player. Lions don't look after cattle, they eat them. The worst part is that Fink openly broadcasts his low opinion of his workers. He outright tells them he sees them as cattle and himself as the lion. Of course, this is meant for the player's consumption, and not the actual workers. But remember, midwits don't fall for propaganda. When DeWitt and Elizabeth finally arrive in Finkton, they witness a job auction in progress.
Now nine, will you give me eight? 9 minutes bid, now nine.
Eight!
8 minutes bid, now eight.
7.5.
7.5 minutes.
6 minutes and 15 seconds.
6 minutes and five.
5 minutes 50. I could do 5 and 50.
5 and 50. I said 5 and 50. Anyone lower than 5 and 50? Coal porter goes to the worker in the blue shirt. We need a pipe fitter here. Crimp a pipe on Pearl Street. Starting bid of 20 minutes. Can I get 19?
18.
18 minutes bid, now 18.
17.
17 minutes bid, now 17.
14.
14 minutes bid, now 14.
10.
10, now 10.
9 and 50.
9 and 50. Any lower now?
9 and 10.
9 and 10.
9, 9, 9.
8 and 33.
I hear 8 and 33. 8 and 33. 8 and 33! We got our fitter in the green shirt!
I need this job.
That's a think man, an efficient man.
Now, the reason a single black man is seen here in Finkton beating on a single Irishman is to massage the idea that men like Fink, through industrial capitalism, invented ethnic racial animus, where there hadn't been any prior. But, as Herbert Hill wrote in The Problem of Race in American Labor History, quote, "Labor historians committed to the belief that racial conflict among workers is a consequence of class relations or an expression of false consciousness, celebrate the episodic occurrences of interracial solidarity while ignoring the overall historical pattern. For the working class to have been divided by external agencies, it would need to have had an original unitary existence. But working class identity does not exist before everything else. It is not primordial. While a multiplicity of factors besides race may have intersected at various times with class, race was decisive in the formation of the white working class during the period of slavery, and again during its recomposition in the Reconstruction period and after." Unquote. Again, Bioshock Infinite's aim here is to hoodwink the white audience into believing that racial divisions were an invention of industrial capitalists to divide workers. But here's the tricky part that so many people seem to get lost in. Guys like Fink didn't invent racial divisions, but they did take advantage of them for personal gain. The fact is, when blacks started moving north in the early 20th century, industrial capitalists were eager to use them to undercut the value of white labor, and African Americans were quite willing participants in this scheme because they themselves held innate animosity toward the white working class, and the terms of employment were still an improvement over their previous condition. Now, one can argue that blacks were happy to do this because white society had racist hiring practices and restricted their inclusion in workers' unions. But this doesn't change the fundamental fact that human tribalism is real, innate, and becomes more pronounced commensurately with increases in scarcity and genetic and cultural dissimilarity of outgroup intrusions. For example, it wasn't white racism that made all the Chinese boxers want to expel white foreigners. To further illustrate just how the character Jeremiah Fink was crafted for the specific aim to demonize white society, here's another instance of Jeremiah Fink's robber baron rants on the intercom.
"Now, some folks just aren't satisfied with their place here at Fink Industries. But I tell you, there's a purpose for all living things. Would the pharaohs of Egypt have been able to stand at the top of their pyramids if the Israelites had not made their bricks? Would the captains of industry have been able to ride the rails had not the Chinamen laid the track for them? So I say, chin up! History is built on the backs of men like you!"
Now, for those who don't know, this is a reference to the construction of the Transcontinental Railroad built in the late 1860s that connected the east and west coasts of the United States for the very first time. Fink's utterance about Chinese workers, however, is much less about industrialists and more about reinforcing the notion that it was always the non-white foreigner who actually built America. Now, yes, the Central Pacific Railroad did hire a lot of Chinese, but Fink just as easily could have referenced the Irish, Germans, and other European workers who made up the majority of the Union Pacific Railroad, which laid more track than the former and had to constantly fight off Indian attacks while doing so. Moreover, and perhaps more importantly, Europeans in North America had already been building railroads long prior. It was Europeans who braved the treacherous journey across the continent on foot and by wagon, and then built the various cities and ports on the west coast, without which there would not have been a need for a transcontinental railroad to begin with. And without the dreaded, racist, evil policy of manifest destiny, indeed, there wouldn't have been a labor market or American economy for the Chinese immigrants to exploit, which in fact they did. As author Gordon Chang writes, quote, "From the viewpoint of the railroad Chinese, though the wage differential based on race was glaring and racial prejudice was openly practiced, they knew that the wages they received were many times greater than what they could earn in the Pearl River Delta as farmers or laborers. Physical risk, even the risk of death, was exceedingly high, but so was their gain relative to what they could make in their home villages." Unquote. Labor at the time was worth much less in China due to basic principles of supply and demand. China had a much larger population, thus it had more labor, and thus the labor was worth much less. So for 19th century Chinese migrants, going to work for the Central Pacific Railroad, even at a lower rate than their white counterparts, was an easy win. They not only made more money than they would have back in China, but unlike the Americans, they didn't have families to support within the local economy. Most Chinamen sent their earnings back home to their wives and children in China, where those earnings had more spending power. Thus, in many ways, the Chinamen exploited America's labor market as much as the industrialists exploited them. But to what extent were the Chinese really exploited? According to Gordon Chang, Chinese general laborers made between, quote, $2.25 to $2.75 a day, but the cost of their board was deducted from 40 cents to $1.25 a day, according to different sources, unquote. If true, that would make their pay come out to about $1 to $1.16 per day, but that's still over double what U.S. Army privates made during the same period. For example, German immigrant Adolf Metzger was earning about $13 a month, or 43 cents a day, when he was killed in a Sioux Cheyenne ambush of his detachment on December 21, 1866. Metzger was the bugler, and thus wasn't armed. He literally died using his bugle as a weapon in hand-to-hand combat for 43 cents a day, while Chinese railroad workers made over double what he did. Now, in addition, if we're going to demonize Metzger and other white immigrants for taking away Native American land, why exactly do the Chinese immigrants who came over originally to mine Native American gold and then subsequently helped build a railroad across their homeland get portrayed as virtuous victims of Mo-white supremacy and not opportunistic, willful participants in the oppression of Native Americans? Regarding the Chinese workers' pay, critics often cite the board deductions as discriminatory. But even Chang notes that, quote, provisions up in the high elevations were expensive, as they all had to be packed in by mule or pack trains, unquote. It should be noted here that the Chinese workers insisted on having their own camps and cooks in order to maintain their own cultural and culinary practices. So, in other words, they required special provisions above and beyond what was normally provided. Critics also like to cite that they were paid less than their Union Pacific counterparts on the other side of the Sierras, who, quote, were paid $3 to $4 per day, unquote. But the white workers of the Central Pacific Line were also paid less than those of the Union Pacific Line. Now, when historians state that the Central Pacific Line saved anywhere from half to two-thirds the amount they would have needed to pay white workers, it's probably very true, but a little misleading. It makes people think that the white laborers of the Central Pacific Line, doing the same work as the Chinese, were getting paid double. The reality is that they were getting paid ever so slightly more than the Chinese, but several times less than their white counterparts on the Union Pacific Line. Consider that in 1867, the Chinese workers had a strike to seek equal pay with white workers of the Central Pacific Line, which Gordon Chang says was $40 a month. According to other sources, it was $35, but let's not quibble. Let's go with $40. At 26 working days per month, that comes out to about $1.53 a day. In other words, more than 2.5 times less than the whites working on the Union Pacific Line, who were paid between $3 and $4 a day. So it's absurdly clear that the Chinese on the Central Pacific Line were depressing white wages. One Irishman of the Central Pacific Line was quite angry about this, saying, quote, "If it wasn't for them damned naggers, we would get $50 and not do half the work," unquote. Now, as an aside to address any confusion here, the Irish at the time pronounced the word nigger as nagger. So, yes, as strange as it may seem, some Irishmen were referring to the Chinese with racial slurs intended for blacks. The main point here, though, is that the Irish clearly understood that the Chinese were undermining the value of their labor. Many historians are also quick to cite the praise of the railroad barons for how much better the Chinese were than the white workers, despite being paid less. It's part of a well-established trope at this point. Everyone does a better job than white people, despite the latter's alleged feelings of supremacy. Most of these praises, however, were taken from a Senate hearing, where Charles Crocker, the principal man behind their hiring for the Central Pacific Line, was essentially justifying his hiring of them over domestic whites at a time when such behavior was frowned upon. In addition to capitalizing off cheap Chinese labor, Crocker was also invested in a steamship line that ran to and from Hong Kong, the profitability of which was called into question by the senators, who suggested that, without heavy immigration and emigration, Crocker's profits would suffer. Crocker was also supposedly an abolitionist before and during the war, a curious fact since he argued repeatedly for there to be one Chinaman for every 10 white Californians, his rationale being that they would elevate the white men to higher, more prestigious positions of labor. This appeal was heartily rejected by the quote-unquote racist senators, however, who felt it violated their morals. Unlike the so-called abolitionists, they didn't want a permanent underclass of subservient Chinamen. At one point, a senator asked him, quote, "Do you not know that one prominent argument advanced by the friends of slavery was that it elevated the white man, gave him a class below him, and that he could employ the slave and make money out of him?" Unquote. The reality is that Charles Crocker was exactly the kind of man Jeremiah Fink better corresponds to. Not a racist, chauvinist, nationalist, but a soulless radical individual willing to sell out his own people for just a little bit more profit. Instead of exploring this nuance, however, Bioshock Infinite prefers to carry on the trope that capitalist exploitation is a product of white racism. Yet no one ever seems to care about how industrialists worked hand in hand with foreign labor to undermine white workers' wages. Consider here something else that Diana Preston wrote in her book on the Boxer Rebellion. Quote, "The steamboats and steam launches, plying busily up China's rivers and canals, have put thousands of bargemen out of work, just as, in other provinces of northern China, railways were destroying the livelihood of camelmen, mule drivers, chair-bearers, and innkeepers." Unquote. I feel the need to highlight here that Preston's assessment strongly parallels the white working class mentality today of, "they took our jobs." Yet I would wager that Preston would frown upon such xenophobic behavior in white Americans. Almost invariably, postmodern historical perspectives involving whites and non-whites condemn white populist movements while they celebrate, or at the very least, heavily sympathize with their non-white counterparts. In the case of Bioshock, the same general set of behaviors is depicted differently depending on the race. For white people, it's racist xenophobia. For the Chinese, blacks, and Native Americans, it's depicted as righteous, justified, and morally sound resistance against foreign tyranny. The bottom line here is that white workers in America didn't like Chinamen coming in and depreciating their wages and building Chinatowns everywhere, any more than the Chinese in China liked the Europeans coming in and disrupting their economy, culture, and customs. Yet, only one side here will ever be deemed an aggressor. Returning to Fink's rant on the loudspeakers back in Finkton, the comparison of 19th century Chinese railroad workers to ancient Israelite slaves building the pyramids is an even more grotesque offense, in my opinion. First off, the Chinese were not slaves. They willingly came over to mine gold and build railroads on, quote-unquote, stolen Native American land. Moreover, the Israelites didn't even come into existence until sometime between 1200 and 1000 BC. The last pyramid was constructed in the late 3rd millennium BC, over 1000 years beforehand. More importantly, the consensus among Egyptologists since the early 2000s has been that the pyramids were not built by slaves, but by members of Egyptian society who volunteered a certain amount of time each year to what they considered to be a public work. Think of the Amish working together to build and move barns, and you probably have a better idea of how the Egyptian workforce functioned. So to refresh everyone's memory, we're in Finkton to look for a Chinese gunsmith named Chen Lin, who Daisy Fitzroy says can supply her and the Vox Populi with weapons. When we finally arrive at Chen Lin's gun shop, it's right next to the job auction and is apparently 100% legitimate and legal, which makes total sense. I mean, why not let a Chinaman run a gun shop in your white ethnostate? What could possibly go wrong with that? It's not like he'd ever supply the foreign hordes you imported with weapons. In the entryway is another one of Daisy Fitzroy's recordings.
"I have a pressing need to speak to this so-called false shepherd, stirring up so much trouble. We got enough problems without this damn fool shooting up the city and blaming it all on the Vox. Though if he's amiable, yeah, he might be just the fellow we need for our immediate concerns."
I don't know what Daisy is talking about. DeWitt never blamed his actions on the Vox Populi, and neither did the Colombians. Most of the game, in fact, the Colombians are speaking quite clearly on their loudspeakers about the false shepherd while they mourn his victims on radio broadcasts. Inside Chinlin's factory, we, of course, find a shrine to Buddha.
I've read about this. That's Gautama Buddha.
Who?
The founder of Buddhism. Spent 49 days under a Bodhi tree until he achieved enlightenment.
Something tells me Comstock doesn't cater to idols getting worship that ain't him.
Again, we have another trope here. All nationalist leaders want to be worshipped because of innate low self-esteem. They're all self-serving egomaniacs. Upstairs, we find that Lin's shop has been ransacked, and he's missing. We then hear a woman crying below us.
Excuse me. Ma'am, I'm sorry to bother you. We're looking for Mr. Lin. Mr. Chen Lin.
Booker.
Mr. Lin, not here. He gone.
Gone?
They take flying squad. I pray, Gautama Buddha, pray, give husband back. Give back to Mei Lin.
Where did they take him?
Club. Everyone take to good time club.
Where is this club? Ma'am, please, where is this club?
Booker, we'll find it. Just leave her be.
Why not Vox Bully help Chen Lin? Why not Daisy Fitzroy help Chen Lin?
Good flying squad.
Cops. Kind who probably got their boot on Lin's throat asking him how well he knows Daisy Fitzroy.
Isn't she the one we're working for?
As a matter of fact, it is. Let's figure out where this good time club is.
Nothing in this scene makes much sense. There's an insinuation that Chen Lin isn't working for the Vox Populi just quite yet. Thus, Comstock's men were wrong for coming after him. But then, Chen Lin's own wife was complaining about how Fitzroy didn't send him any help, implying that they indeed already had a working relationship. Either way, though, white man bad. We also should appreciate here how Elizabeth scolds DeWitt for being too insistent to this poor, grieving Chinese woman who speaks broken English. Better still is that afterwards, DeWitt himself expresses his own disapproval of Columbia's actions. But are Colombians just supposed to sit back and do nothing if they suspect Chen is supplying their enemies with weapons? I guess so. I guess that's the message here. Defending your country is evil if you're a white man. Skipping ahead a bit, we find ourselves inside the Good Time Club, where Chen Lin is being held. Fink speaks to us over the loudspeakers.
Ah, DeWitt, my boy! You know, the best kind of interview is one where the applicant doesn't know he's being evaluated. But I've watched you since the other day at the lottery. You're a brute! And in times like this, I could use a brute!
What do you want, Fink?
My labor unrest is coming, DeWitt. Now, Fitzroy has got the jungle all riled up. A man like me could have use of an old Pinkerton like you.
Again, this serves to highlight more of DeWitt's evil past as a Pinkerton agent, and as an enemy of the working man, or as Daisy might put it, the common folk. Remember, the idea being pushed here is that ethnic groups don't compete for resources unless men like Fink and DeWitt force them to do so. The scene here also further cements the villainy of Fink, who, if you notice, has killed his former head of security and put his body on public display. There's no nuance here at all. It's just gratuitous violence to heighten the player's sense that Fink is a bad man, and the nation he represents is evil. The scene is fairly nonsensical. How could Fink have possibly thought that showing off his former dead head of security's body would warm you up to the idea of assuming the position yourself? Moving into the main hall, Fink subjects you to an audition, whereby you kill several waves of Colombian racists. There's no rationale given as to why Fink's men would volunteer to be used as cannon fodder in such a context. In theory, until someone kills them, there will be no head of security. In other words, if they don't kill you, eventually, Fink will find someone who will. Again, why would they go along with this? Fink may not be a true believer in Colombia's religious causes, but a lot of his minions are. And while they would probably want to kill you because you're the false shepherd, it seems logical that they'd find Fink's desire to hire you as his head of security somewhat counter to their religious and nationalistic beliefs. In any event, after you kill all the racists, the backstage curtains open up, and you can enter the makeup room, where another one of Jeremiah Fink's recordings sits on a table.
I had thought you a fool, dear brother, when you told me that you heard wonderful music trumpeting from holes in the thin air. I began to doubt your mental integrity, but not only have you made your fortune from these doodads, you have lit the path for me as well.
Now, it isn't exactly evident here unless you've already played through the entire game, but Fink is talking about how his brother, Albert Fink, became the musical genius of Columbia. Not due to his own ability, of course, but rather to the fact that dimensional tears in his studio allowed him to plagiarize music he heard from other dimensions. Here's a clip of DeWitt and Elizabeth coming across a random tear in Finkton to illustrate the point.
You hear that? Music. It's coming from that tear.
I never heard that song before.
I don't suspect anyone's heard that song.
Note that if Elizabeth and DeWitt heard this music in the middle of a textile shop, then in theory anyone could, and thus anyone could plagiarize it. So did the Finks have a monopoly on this or not? Putting this illogical inconsistency aside for a moment, remember this concept of plagiarism, because it ties into the whole white men stole all their achievements trope. Moving on again, there's a back door which leads into a dungeon, because nothing is more symbolic of the moral rot of white society as Colombians enjoying plays and operas while countless Negro souls suffer in agony below them. Eventually, we see Chen Lin's cell written on a chalkboard, and while Elizabeth is picking a lock, DeWitt speaks more about his past as a Pinkerton agent.
I used to work for folks like Fink.
Really?
And I was with the Pinkertons. They call us in when the workers got restless.
To do what?
Demonstrate the folly of men striking. Throwing down tools.
You hurt people.
I'll tell you this. Sometimes there's precious need for folks like Fitzroy.
Why?
Because of folks like me.
There.
So again, even DeWitt himself, the protagonist, quote-unquote, is telling the players that Fitzroy is his moral superior, and that he is, in fact, an enemy of the people. In the room up ahead, we come across the interrogation film of Chen Lin.
Tell us what you know about Fitzroy, you goddamn gook. You know you can hear us. You want to say something? Or you want us to bring in Mrs. Lin for company? Throw a bucket of ice water on him. We got three more to bring in tonight.
In the entrance to the prison cells, there is another recording of Comstock sitting next to a set of handcuffs that are highly reminiscent of chains on a slave ship.
What could people have done to deserve to be locked up in a place like this?
Fink don't need much of a reason.
No. No, he doesn't.
To tax the black more than the white, is that not cruel? To forbid the mixing of the races, is that not cruel? To give the vote to the white man and deny it to the yellow, the black, the red, is that not cruel? But is it not cruel to banish your children from a perfect garden? Or drown your flock under an ocean of water. Cruelty can be instructive. And what is Columbia, if not the schoolhouse of the Lord?
Now, here's some food for thought. Would Comstock's character, as presented thus far, really think that preventing race mixing was quote-unquote cruel? Considering Fink imported Negro convicts to put on display at the raffle, would Colombians, as Ken Levine has betrayed them thus far, think taxing them more than whites was quote-unquote cruel? As for voting rights, why would an apartheid state based on caricatures of the Jim Crow South believe denying the vote to non-whites was quote-unquote cruel? Either the developers had no self-awareness, or they were implying that Comstock is much more than just misguided, because he knows what he's doing is wrong, yet he does it anyway. DeWitt and Elizabeth eventually make their way down the hall to Chen Lin's cell, which turns out to be situated in an even deeper, darker dungeon. We come to a pitch-black room with a light switch. We flip it on and discover that poor Chen Lin has been murdered by the evil white supremacists of Columbia.
Now we need to find someone else to make those guns.
No.
Dead is dead, Elizabeth.
Dead is dead.
What? The hell did...
I see.
heads.
And I see tails.
It's all a matter of perspective.
Why are you following us? Who sent you? Comstock? What do you want?
What do you see here, from this angle?
Dead.
Listen.
And that angle?
Alive.
Walker. Chen Lin.
The body's gone.
It was never here.
It's another Columbia.
A different Columbia.
The same coin.
A different perspective.
Heads.
Tails.
Dead.
Alive.
We have to go through to this other Columbia, but how?
It's like riding a bicycle.
One never really forgets.
One just needs the courage to climb aboard.
If we go into this tear, I don't think he'll be able to bring us back. Are you sure you're ready?
Okay, open it.
Look, there's no blood.
And no body.
It's another world, Booker. Another Columbia.
Something tells me one dead gunsmith ain't the only thing that's changed.
As another quick aside to highlight the logical inconsistencies, do note here that the ending of Bioshock Infinite's story reveals that DeWitt didn't remember who he was initially, because as the opening line states, interdimensional travel causes a kind of cognitive dissonance, and the Traveler thus creates a new set of false memories to cope. Yet, nothing of the sort seems to happen here. Both Elizabeth and DeWitt are completely unaffected when they travel through this portal. As they go back upstairs, it appears that this Columbia is no less cruel than the one they just left. Remember, constants and variables. Dozens and dozens of blacks and Irish folks are imprisoned. As if somehow Ken Levine wanted to express that Columbia's Christian white nationalism oppresses white people as much as non-whites. But then again, the Irish aren't white, are they? So he can't really be saying that. Or can he? After all, we did just irreversibly travel through an interdimensional portal to get weapons from an otherwise dead Chinese gunsmith in a white ethnostate for a genius IQ black woman who, in theory, could have just flown down to the Sodom below to purchase weapons using the magical airship she currently has in her possession. As another aside, there's zero reason to think that the new iteration of Fitzroy we're going to meet will even know about or share the agreement we had with the other version of herself. Regardless, on the way out of the dungeon, sitting underneath of the Good Times Club, we see a film of Chen Lin's interrogation from this new reality.
Daisy Fitzroy. Come on, you piece of horseshit. Tell me about Daisy.
Cut him loose.
What?
Scarfield says cut him loose. Then bringing his tools to the lockup. That'll keep him clean, I guess.
Why?
What are you, the Columbia Gazette? The chink's wife got friends in high places. Come on. We need to sell.
In this new reality, it appears that Chen's wife has some serious political clout, which is very interesting. Do take note. In the next room, Elizabeth and DeWitt have a short conversation about how a lot of things could be different from their previous reality, in that they'll soon find out why Chen wasn't killed in this one. Passing by the Colombian soldiers we killed on our way in, we find out that these new versions were not killed in this reality, but nevertheless somehow remember being killed in the Columbia we just left. The idea being presented here is that memories from one reality become shared as a person crosses over into a new one. But these soldiers never crossed over into a new reality. Only DeWitt and Elizabeth did. The only way they could remember being killed is if the version of themselves from this reality entered the reality DeWitt and Elizabeth just left, which has not happened. All of this is on top of the idea that DeWitt doesn't remember that Anna is his daughter because he invented new memories when the Lutesses brought him into the original reality at the start of the game. The reason why I'm being so autistic about this is to highlight that the writers prioritize certain plot elements, even when doing so would violate the game's own internal logic. This should stress just how important they felt the ending revelation was, which is that you, the player, were the villain all along. Once on the theater stage again, Fink's security detail, headed by the same man whom Fink had previously killed and hung on display, attacks us on sight. After killing them all, we come across a new kinetoscope revealing that Chen Lin was set free because of his brother-in-law, the head of Fink Security, who, ironically, is the guy we just killed. Curiously, in this new Columbia, Chen Lin was allowed to marry a prominent white woman, and no, this is never explained, and no, this Columbia is just as racist as the one we just left. Exiting the Good Time Club, we battle our way through another horde of racists. It seems in this reality, Fink no longer wants to hire you and has the entire job board for Finkton plastered with a call to kill you. Rounding the corner, we return to Chen Lin's gun shop. Inside, we discover that the shrine to Buddha has been replaced with a shrine to Father Comstock. Chen Lin is upstairs, but he appears to be in an estranged state.
Mr. Lin? Chen Lin? Excuse me, Chen Lin?
Who are you? You speak up! Speak up! Can't hear you over all these machines! Very loud!
I'm Booker DeWitt.
Stand back! These machines very dangerous. Wait downstairs with Mrs. Lin.
Daisy Fitzroy sent us. We need to talk to you about getting some weapons.
Machines very dangerous. No place for stupid people.
Want to lose pretty head?
Mr. Lin.
Downstairs.
What is wrong with him?
Remember him dead in that cell? Maybe in some way he remembers that too. How would you reconcile that?
I don't know.
Well, Elizabeth asks here how DeWitt would reconcile the fact of having died in another reality. I don't know, but I can tell you that Chen Lin doesn't seem to be crawling all over the floor telling everybody how much he fucking hates himself.
I'm disgusted. Disgusting. Sick. Sick. Sick.
Kill my husband? Calm his troubled thoughts. Ease his burden. Bring Chen Lin back to me.
Excuse me, ma'am. I'm looking for Mrs. Lin.
I'm Mrs. Lin?
No, I mean a little Chinese lady. She was...
Booker, this is Mrs. Lin. They took Chen's tools. What's he got without his tools?
Well, your husband is a bit out of sorts.
If he could work again, maybe... If he could work, he'd... Mrs. Lin, can you tell me who took your husband's tools?
Goddamn police. They took them and locked them up in the impound in Shantytown.
Is she real? Would having his tools back fix his mind?
Who cares? We're not getting any guns if Chen Lin doesn't have his tools. Let's head to Shantytown.
So not only is there never any explanation as to how this mixed-race marriage was allowed in a white ethnostate, but this white woman is praying to Comstock as if he were a living god. What's more, she's praying for him to save her Chinese husband. When we exit Chen Lin's shop, Elizabeth asks DeWitt if he noticed Chen's bloody nose.
Did you notice? Lin had a bloody nose.
Seems to be in style.
This Tara... I'm not so sure it was a good idea.
Now, this is a very minor utterance, but it's the first one that Elizabeth makes in a series of statements alluding to a notion that her behavior is having a negative impact on everyone around her. Going forward, the game will blame Elizabeth just as much as DeWitt for all the ills befalling the people around them. From here, we head towards Shantytown. Along the way, Elizabeth brings up her deformity again. That is, the missing tip of her pinky. Then we fight our way through yet more racists, and eventually we take an elevator down to Shantytown. Because after all, even though we're in a city in the clouds, Shantytown has to symbolically be below everything else for effect.
You must think me some sort of freak. A girl who can bring dead men back to life. Whose only acquaintance is a giant bird creature. I must seem ridiculous.
You just got dealt a bad hand.
I am not going back to that tower, no matter what happens.
They won't stop until they have you.
Why? What did I do to them?
You frightened them.
Good.
This ties into the idea that white men are actually afraid of their women. Sure, this doesn't really make much sense because Comstock wants his daughter to sit the throne and drown in flame the mountains of man, but again, this game has a lot of overlapping, self-contradicting messages. When we step off the elevator into Shantytown, we're of course met with a black man preaching about economic exploitation and how Daisy Fitzroy has another way coming real soon. Barely two steps farther, and Elizabeth starts making naive comments about Shantytown's poverty and how Fink is to blame for it all.
These people are like this because of Fink? Maybe Daisy's right. Maybe she should pay him back for all of this.
Not before she pays us. We're here for guns and then the airship.
Now, again, I'm not here to defend the robber barons, but rather to undermine the silly trope that they held back the social and economic development of black people. If anything, a more accurate depiction here would be that these poor Irish were made to live in these conditions because Fink insisted on importing Negro convicts to undermine their wages. The irony here is that, of course, Shantytown is a shithole. Fink knowingly imported Negro convicts. Though I imagine that Irrational Games didn't want you to seriously think that those were actual convicts, but rather just doctors and engineers who didn't do nothing. Consider that while it's mostly black people in Shantytown, the people who try to rob you are Irish.
Privileged types.
Spare some coin, friend. Not all of us are gainfully employed down here, and a man's gotta eat.
In any event, if Columbia were truly representative of white racial animus toward non-whites during the time period, then the Irish here would probably throw Fink off the nearest edge for importing the Sodom below into their New Eden. But once again, the idea Bioshock wants to drill home is that whiteness, quote-unquote, causes Shantytown. Making our way further ahead, Elizabeth makes the point more explicit.
I don't understand why some people are treated like men, and others like animals.
There's plenty of places down below where you'll find more of the same.
Like a Wounded Knee.
Yeah, like a Wounded Knee.
In case you didn't spot it, the people in Shantytown are apparently growing their own food, but the evil Colombian officials sealed it off with fences and barbed wire because the inhabitants were Vox Populi sympathizers. Now, one of the main reasons workers flocked to urban areas in the mid and late 19th century was because they felt that the agrarian lifestyles they had before couldn't offer as much. Yet Irrational Games is acting as if these were all anti-racist hippie communes who would have been completely self-sufficient were it not for racist capitalists confiscating their crops. Up ahead, we come across a vandalized automated barber station that is Jewish. At first, I thought maybe the Vox Populi were anti-Semitic, but then you can clearly hear a racist Colombian cop, a female Colombian cop, by the way, up ahead ranting about the evil foreigners. After killing all the racists again, we ride the sky rails up to a spot where Preston Downs has another voxophone for us.
Well, Fitzroy, you got a little cunning in you, if nothing else. Dropped a couple grizzly traps around the lines up here. Idea was to bleed one of your couriers till he gave you up. Except, of course, you're using kids now. Now I got this tiny engine boy eyeballing me. Had to take his leg off. Damn thing's just lying here between us. I sure wish he'd cry or something.
So Preston Downs wants to catch the Vox riding around on the sky rails with a bear trap? I guess I shouldn't laugh too much because not only did it work, but he caught yet another minority group in the white ethnostate. Somehow, despite Preston's earlier enthusiastic recollections of scalping both whites and Indians, he suddenly has great sympathy for this little Sioux boy who just lost his leg. Though what really stands out here is the beginning of Irrational Games' attempt to portray the other side. Preston's disapproval of Fitzroy using children is supposed to somewhat undermine her morality. The game from here on out will pretend, to an extent, to be even-handed, but considering that, in the end, Elizabeth needs to kill every instance of her father across all universes and thereby retroactively abort herself, I think their even-handedness fell flat. We now enter Shantytown's police station, where we have to, you guessed it, kill everyone in the building. I'm just going to stop here and highlight how absurd this plot device is. We've literally killed scores and scores of Colombian police officers and military personnel at this point. Now we're going to kill everyone in the Shantytown police station to get Chenlin's tools so he can make weapons for the Vox Populi. Among many other things here, it stands to reason that if Fitzroy can't do this herself, then perhaps that means she's weaker than Colombian forces, meaning we're much stronger than both the Vox Populi and Colombia. So, why didn't we just kill her and take back Comstock's airship? Because that, my friends, would be racist. Once again, we come across another voxophone from Daisy Fitzroy.
They argued some fierce at night, Lady Comstock and a prophet. Could never make out what it was about from my bunk, though. After the worst, I seen she ain't left for morning prayer. So I crept upstairs to check in on her. Like a fool, I lingered. Scullery maid was what they called me when I walked into Comstock House. Murderer was what they shouted when I ran out.
Not only does this prove to the player that Daisy Fitzroy is innocent of murdering Lady Comstock, but the larger implication is that the police knew it. So I guess you shouldn't feel so bad about murdering the entire lot of them. Down in the basement, on our way to get Chenlin's tools, Elizabeth posits another question.
Who are we really helping by getting guns for the Vox Populi?
It's gonna help us.
Daisy can make a change, can't she? Make things better for the people here.
Sure.
A seed is being planted here. DeWitt is clearly helping the Vox for his own selfish gains, but the narrative is starting to turn on Elizabeth as well. She, like DeWitt, now doubts her own morality. It'll make more sense in a bit. For now, note the jail cell with the dead black woman inside it. When we finally get the Chenlin's tools, Booker realizes that they can't carry them out.
Well, we sure as hell aren't gonna be able to carry all this back to the shop. God, we didn't think this all the way through. What is that?
It looks like a tear. To another version of this room that doesn't have any tools in it.
Well, if the tools aren't in there, then...
then they must be back at the shop.
As another quick aside, this game is based on a premise of infinite realities, and yet, for some reason, the conclusion...